You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Strobe Talbot, and I'm very glad to welcome you all here this morning. I see that most of you are dressed properly for the weather outside. I look forward to taking off my tie and jacket in due course. I also appreciate that even though we're in the dog days of summer, that so many of you have come out to join in a discussion of a particularly important and often changing triangle in the geometry of international relations and international security. I'm talking about, of course, the relationship among the United States, the Soviet Union / Russia, and China, of course. As so many of you know, back in the first decade of the Cold War, the government here in Washington and many other governments around the world thought about the monolith of the Sino-Soviet relationship. They thought in terms of a kind of axis between Moscow and Beijing. Yet that having already incentivized the United States to begin in the 60s its misadventure in Indochina, the relationship between the Soviet Union and China was already very much changing. In fact, in 1961, really before the buildup of American forces in Indochina, the Chinese Communist Party denounced its Soviet counterparts as revisionist traitors. And then in 1969, of course, the relationship came to blows, particularly in the form of the border war along the Amur and Ussuri rivers. Now, the Nixon administration, of course, saw in this crisis both danger and an opportunity, and particularly an opportunity for a double breakthrough in the form of detente with the Soviet Union and the opening to China. Now, flashing forward to today, which I think has kind of a theme about it as we look around the world, and that theme is back to the future. On the surface, it would seem that a revanchist Russia and an assertive China are making common cause to thwart U.S. global security policy and weaken U.S. alliances in parts of the world that they regard to be their spheres of influence. And that's the backdrop for our panel. We have three colleagues who are associated with Brookings. Chung Lee, who is the director of the John L. Thornton China Center. Fiona Hill, who is the director of our Center on the U.S. and Europe. And Yun Sun, who is at the Simpson Center, but is also an alumna of the Brookings Institution and still has an affiliate with us. But I want to particularly thank our special guest, Stapleton Roy, who I think I met when I was a very, very junior reporter in the Moscow Bureau of Time magazine in 1969. And I'm sure he gave me great insight and wisdom on what was going on the Soviet and Chinese border. He went on, of course, to be one of the most distinguished diplomats of his generation, and I would say pretty much any generation, a revered ambassador to the PRC, also a good friend of Brookings over the years. So now I'm going to turn the proceedings over to Chung Lee to get this conversation going, and I'm sure there will be time to bring you into that conversation yourself.
Thank you so much, Strobe, for those extremely insightful remarks and for taking part in today's session, despite your very busy schedule. I understand that you probably on call for some important meetings, so feel free to leave anytime, but also, and please stay if you can. You know, I think that probably the audience also have a couple of questions addressed to you. You can continue to share with us your wisdom. And it will be hard to find a better person than you to offer an historical account and also the future outlook on U.S.-China-Russian trilateral relations. When he was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, he translated the Soviet leader Khrushchev's memoirs into English, two volumes. And during crucial periods of the Cold War, he wrote several books on U.S.-Russian relations and also on disarmament. He served as the Deputy Secretary of State and Ambassador at Large on the new independent states following the Soviet breakup. Early in his career as a Time magazine correspondent, Strobe covered Nixon and Kissinger's opening of China. In the wake of the 1989 Tiananmen incident, he wrote a highly influential article entitled How Not to Break China. Only a few weeks ago, when we were together in China, I witnessed Strobe's engaging dialogues with Chinese leaders and the Chinese public intellectuals discussing the challenges and opportunities presented by ongoing changes in the global geopolitical landscape. Strobe, your expert knowledge and your strategic vision are truly invaluable at this perplexing time in global affairs, especially regarding major power relations. Thank you so much. Can we have another round of applause? Well, I want to join Strobe in welcoming you all to this important discussion. Is the United States losing China to Russia? ? The title of the event is not intended to echo the American debate over who lost China in the middle of the last century, but it does remind us of the fact that improvements in U.S.-China relations in the 70s and the 80s provided many advantages to the United States as it strived to win the Cold War. But today, the trilateral relationship between the United States, China, and Russia has profoundly changed. U.S. relations with China and Russia both seem to be deteriorating. Meanwhile, China and Russia are strengthening their strategic partnership, or even something, or someone will call closer to an alliance. Some strategic thinkers in the United States have begun to worry about what they call an uneasy triangle. Chinese analysts have adopted a new term, the term called the new Three Kingdom, Xin San Guo Yan Yi. This is a term frequently appear in Chinese discourse, to characterize the situation of today and try to explore its implications. Now, are we entering a new Cold War? What serves the best interest of each of these three powers? Is it risky for the United States to be on footing, hostile footing, with both China and Russia while confronting other challenges, such as ISIS and North Korea? Unfortunately, these important questions are not being adequately debated in the United States. Even during this heated campaign season, partisan rhetoric should not overshadow the need for sound strategic discourse. Now, we have three excellent panelists to share with us their insights and perspectives to address these important questions. Ambassador Roy, on my right, is not only a China-born sinologist, but he also specialized in Soviet affairs and served in Moscow, as Strobe mentioned, in the heat of the Cold War. He served as ambassador to Singapore, Indonesia, the People's Republic of China, and also as a national, also as the assistant secretary of the state for intelligence and research. My colleague, Fiona Hill, is director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the foreign policy program here at the Brookings. From 2006 to 2009, she served as a national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia in the National Intelligence Council. A co-author of the best-selling book, Mr. Putin, Fiona is one of the most sought-after commentators on Russian and Eurasia affairs. Last but certainly not least, Sun Yun is a senior associate with the East Asia Program at the Simpson Center. She is also an honorary fellow in the African Growth Initiative here at the Brookings. Prior to these appointments, these positions, she was the China analyst for the International Crisis Group based in Beijing. And her research really covered a wide range of geographic regions and topics. In terms of geographic region, she really an expert on the China-Africa relations and African development, and also East and Southeast Asia, and finally, Sino-Russian relations. So welcome you all for three panelists. Now, each of them will give 10 minutes remarks and followed by a discussion that I will moderate. And then after that, we will open the floor for Q&A. So we go with this order. Ambassador Roy, please.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. First, a comment on the title. The United States never had China to lose. If we did lose it, it was long ago before I joined the Foreign Service. I think it would be more accurate to ask which country occupies the favored position in the triangular relationship, in the sense of having the better relationship with the other two. It was the United States for a long time. And now it's China. Now, some people date the improvement in Russian-Chinese relations to the collapse of the Soviet Union. But actually, the gradual normalization of the relations between the two countries began long before that. In the American embassy, which had just opened up in Beijing in 1979 after the establishment of diplomatic relations, we detected a warming trend in Russian-Chinese relations back in 79 and 1980. It was reflected in the fact that border problems between the two countries that used to take months to resolve all of a sudden could be resolved in a day or two. And also, the Chinese have been concerned from the very beginning of the relationship, dating from President Nixon's visit to Beijing in 1972, that the United States was trying to stand on Chinese shoulders in order to get at the Soviet Union. So even though we had a binding element in the U.S.-China relationship based on the common concern about the Soviet threat, China felt that we were using China against Russia, and this gave them an incentive to want to have a better relationship with Russia. It was the intervention of the Russians in Afghanistan that held back that trend. But it resumed again as soon as the Russians began their withdrawal from Afghanistan. So we need a long-term perspective on this relationship in order to understand the dynamic that was going on. Certainly, the disintegration of the Soviet Union in 1991, which was occurring right at the moment when I was presenting my credentials to the president of China, and we spent, in our discussion was not on U.S.-China relations, but on what was going on in the Soviet Union. And both of our information came from CNN, because there were very dramatic developments taking place on the television screen. But the collapse of the Soviet Union and the reemergence of Deng Xiaoping pragmatism in China had removed the element of ideological rivalry from the relationship between Beijing and Moscow. From China's standpoint, of course, the collapse of the Soviet Union was a very desirable development. And obviously, the Russians had a somewhat different perspective on that development. But regardless of these contributing factors, the reality is that Russian-Chinese relations are probably the best in modern history. The two countries have good reasons for strategic cooperation. They're both opposed to a world dominated by a sole superpower that isn't one of them. They both feel threatened by U.S. unilateralism, U.S. interventionism, and U.S. support for color revolutions. So they always both suspect the United States is out to change the political systems in their countries in ways that we prefer and that they do not appreciate. Their economies are complementary. Russia is a supplier of military goods, energy, and raw materials, and China as a supplier of capital, consumer goods, and equipment. They have a common interest in not having Central Asia become a breeding ground for terrorism. So these common factors are sufficient to hold in check Russia's strategic insecurities caused by the rapid rise of China occurring at the very moment when Russia was declining as a major power because of the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And another factor is these common interests hold in check China's latent ambitions to consolidate its position in Central Asia, South Asia, and the Middle East. Neither country sees its interests as served by forming a strategic alliance against the United States. The statistics speak for themselves. Although Sino-Russian trade has increased 20-fold over the last 25 years, reaching a level of $100 billion in 2014, the reality is that U.S.-China trade is about six times larger. China doesn't forget that. In other words, the economic relationship with the United States is fundamentally more important to China than the one with Russia. Chinese investment is pouring into Russia, and there's essentially no reverse investment from Russia. So that the hundreds of billions of dollars of foreign direct investment in China that has speeded along its economic development doesn't come from Russia. It comes from the United States and Western countries and neighbors of China. Until the Ukraine crisis in 2014, I think you could accurately characterize Russian-Chinese relations as strong, healthy, and friendly. This was reflected in public opinion polling in both countries, which was very different from the period when I served in Moscow, when Russians were acutely suspicious of the Chinese. But the Chinese consistently rated Russia as the country toward which they had the least suspicions. The United States, Japan, even South Korea ranked lower in Chinese perceptions. And you had a considerable easing of the public attitudes in Russia toward China, but not to the degree that was taking place on the Chinese side. But after the Ukraine crisis, I would characterize the relations as friendly, close, but unhealthy, because Russia has been forced uncomfortably close to China, because of the confrontation with NATO over the Ukraine issue. As a result, Russia now has to go along with Chinese initiatives that Russians are inherently concerned about and suspicious of. This is not a sufficient factor to undermine the strong ties based on their strategic interests in not having a world dominated by an interventionist United States. But it means that this is not a relationship in which there is an equal sense of mutual benefit emerging from the relationship. So this Ukrainian development is a very important factor in the bilateral relationship. For example, the Russians were very suspicious of China's drive in the Central Asia, and most recently reflected in the One Belt, One Road initiative. And it was in 2014 that they ended up endorsing the initiative, and that's after the Ukraine crisis had emerged. As a Russian official commented privately to me, we had no choice but to go along with the initiative. So that reflects the change in the relationship. Former Deputy Foreign Minister Fu Ying of China had an article in the Foreign Affairs magazine in January, February of this year. And it provides a pretty good description of relations between China and Russia, noting both the positive elements and the underlying concerns on each side. She pointed out, for example, that she called the relationship as, let me use the right terminology, she called it a stable strategic partnership, not a marriage of convenience, complex, sturdy, and deeply rooted. Okay, well, that sounds pretty good. But she said that changes in international relations since the end of the Cold War have brought the two countries closer together. Now, that's simply a polite Chinese way of saying that U.S. behavior since the end of the Cold War has driven the two countries closer together. At the same time, she acknowledged that China's rise has produced discomfort among some in Russia. And in discussing that issue, she noted the following points. There is still talk in Russia of the China threat. A 2008 poll by Russia's Public Opinion Foundation showed that around 60% of Russians were concerned that Chinese migration to Russia's far eastern border areas would threaten Russia's territorial integrity. 41% of Russians believed that a stronger China would harm Russia's interests. Russians are worried that China is competing for influence in their neighborhood. I've mentioned the hesitance in supporting the Silk Road Economic Belt Initiative. But on the Chinese side, former Deputy Foreign Minister Fu Ying noted as well, some Chinese continue to nurse historical grievances regarding Russia. Despite the formal resolution of their border disputes, which have been settled by both sides with compromises on territorial issues, Chinese commentators sometimes make critical references to the nearly 600,000 square miles of Chinese territory that Tsarist Russia annexed in the late 19th century. So there is no question that China was unhappy with Russian behavior in the Ukraine. While China stopped short of direct criticism, Fu Ying in her article noted that the foreign ministry spokesperson in Beijing spoke up saying that Ukraine's independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity should be respected. This was after Russia had already separated off Crimea and joined it back into the Russian Federation. This, from China's standpoint, was a horrible precedent. Because when Chen Shui-bian was the president in Taiwan, he had come up with ideas of holding referenda on Taiwan, on UN membership for Taiwan, and other sensitive issues. And Beijing was strongly opposed to using such referenda, which it viewed as a sort of backdoor way of trying to stimulate independence-minded thinking in Taiwan. And here is Russia using a referendum in Crimea to separate territory that Russia had formally recognized as part of the Ukraine and joining it back together with Russia. So this was a bad precedent. Secondly, the Russian armed intervention in the eastern parts of the Ukraine to prevent Kiev from restoring central control over its eastern territories brought to mind the U.S. CIA-backed intervention in Tibet during the early stages of the Cold War, and China's nightmare is that foreign powers would try to intervene inside China and exploit separatist sentiments in areas such as Tibet and Xinjiang. So in other words, while China didn't formally criticize Russia over its behavior, it clearly had very deep reservations about having these types of international precedents established. So let me conclude just with a brief comment. I was attending a trilateral conference among U.S., Russians, and Chinese shortly after the Ukraine intervention, and the Chinese, who had been very circumspect before in commenting negatively on Russian behavior and generally treating the Sino-Russian relationship as all sweetness and light, at the very opening of the conference, one of the Chinese looked at the Russians and said, "Your actions in Ukraine have implications for East Asia." This was a way of reminding the Russians that they were behaving in a way that affected Chinese interests in a negative way. Having sat in on numerous conversations with both high-level Russian leaders, because of my relationship with Dr. Kissinger, the high-level Russian leaders don't meet with me independently, but I've also been in numerous meetings with high-level Chinese officials, partly because of my status as a former U.S. ambassador or an active U.S. ambassador, and partly because of my relationship with Dr. Kissinger. I have not been in a relation with a Russian leader in which they have not expressed concerns about China, and I have not heard a single statement since the collapse of the Soviet Union from any senior Chinese official expressing strategic concern about China. So that tells you something about the way that the relationship has changed. It's a good, close relationship based on very important strategic interests between the two countries. But from China's standpoint, it's the result of positive developments that have strengthened China's position in the bilateral relationship. And from Russia's position, China is acting as a good friend in need, but they still see China's rise as posing strategic challenges for Russia that they are deeply concerned about. Thank you.
Fascinating. Thank you for that very comprehensive and analytical account. And we will go back to some of your excellent points. Fiona?
Well, that was so comprehensive that I think that Sun and I can go out for coffee, actually.
Boy, you don't have to go out.
Yeah, we'll have to go out. We've used ours up. We're very privileged to have Ambassador Roy here. I mean, as you can hear from this tour de force that also takes us back so long in this relationship, we couldn't really... apart from Strob, have a better interlocutor and opening presentation for this. I mean, as I was sitting listening to him, I also wondered why we didn't call the title "Losing Russia to China." You know, it's as you scoped out the events of this decade, dating back to the 1960s, and taking us through the various efforts of. Russia and China to engage with each other, it became very clear that we've been on such dramatically different trajectories in these relationships. The US and China obviously having a rather difficult relationship, but a very carefully managed one at this juncture, at least we hope so. And Russia and the United States now going almost full circle in 30 years. You mentioned the efforts of the 1980s of China and the Soviet Union to work out the relationships. And if we think back to that period, of course, Gorbachev had some bad timing in his visit to China with Tiananmen Square in 1989. But that juncture of 1989 looked quite hopeful for US and then Soviet relationships. We seem to be on a very different path from where we'd expect ourselves to be now. So we do have this strong juxtaposition, and I do think it. You know, we also should, we could have had this title: "Is the United States losing Russia to China, or did we already lose it?" As you've mentioned, this has become a relationship between Russia and China that has very strong strategic elements, and I think you've very eloquently outlined all of the bases for this. We see China and Russia having very few differences in international organizations. They both have a very similar perspective on the utility of the United Nations. Both are very careful about the positions that they hold in the UN Security Council. There's a great deal of coordination of positions there, even if there might be some differences. Both of them have taken advantage of the BRICS organization and seeing themselves as leading players in that. Also the G20 and many other new organizations. There's, of course, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that China and Russia set up together that has aspirations for a larger role in international affairs. You didn't really mention that there, but it does come out of that relationship that the two of them have been trying to forge in their shared neighborhood in Central Asia. But I think one issue that we should bear in mind here, although we're very much focused on this strategic triangle of relations, that we're not in the Nixon era anymore. Now, our recent presidential campaign might have suggested that we are. I mean, I've been following, like everybody else has, all of the reporting and the convention. We've had Nixon raised in many other different perspectives, not just in the form of Nixon to China that you've raised. But this is a much more complex world that we're in. This is not just a relationship among the US, China, and Russia. There are many other players, and I think you've also started to bring that out in your presentation. The rise of China, especially economically, since 2010, against the backdrop of the global economic and financial crisis and the Eurozone crisis, has changed everybody's calculations. And I think if we start looking further afield, both in the Asia-Pacific region and also in Europe, we see that everybody is factoring China in a different way, in many cases, sometimes to Russia's detriment. So it's not just an issue of how Russia perceives its relationship with the United States against the backdrop of the relationship with China, but how Russia, the United States, and other countries are also managing their own complex relationships and trying to figure out how they also pivot towards Asia and China. If we look at the Asia Pacific, another of the countries that you're intimately familiar with, Ambassador Roy, Japan, is also in the process of trying to figure out how it balances its relations with Russia and also China. Russia has proposed, in fact, to the Japanese behind the scenes, the creation of a new Asia-Pacific security arrangement. Many of you will be very well aware that Prime Minister Abe of Japan has been very eager in improving the relationship with Russia. There is a couple of major points that are obstacles in that relationship. Both of them are interrelated, in fact. One is the fact that Japan and Russia have yet to conclude a peace treaty since World War II because largely of the stumbling block of a territorial dispute over what the Japanese call the Northern Territories and what Russia calls the Kuril Islands that were seized, several of the islands in the southern part of the Kuril's chain, seized by the Soviet Union in the closing days of World War II. There's been many Japanese attempts and Russian attempts to resolve this issue, and we're in again another phase of this, which is again driven by external factors. The Japanese are very much concerned about what they now see as an existential threat in the worsening of their relations with China, and are hoping to have Russia as a counterbalance to China in the Asia-Pacific. And Russia would also like Japan to be a counterbalance to the United States in the Asia-Pacific, but also to China in the future. Because as you've already suggested, there are worries and concerns that Russia has, not just in its shared neighbourhood with Russia in Central Asia, but also in the Asia-Pacific region. In 2013, the Russians and Chinese engaged in some joint naval manoeuvres, which have been repeated on a number of occasions, and most recently they've engaged in naval manoeuvres in the Mediterranean. But after the manoeuvres in the Asia-Pacific region, the Chinese warships took a scenic route back, not directly back to base, and went over the top of Japan through the Sea of Ohotsk and scared the bejesus out of the Russians and the Japanese. And you can see after that point in 2013, you know, the Chinese were quite open about this, but they hadn't actually notified the Russians that was the chosen route home. It's all through international waters. But you can imagine that going north to go back to Japan rather than going straight to go back to China and around Japan instead of going south got some attention. And after this, we saw an uptick in Russian interest in closer relations with Japan. So we can see here there's a lot of complexity in this relationship. China also launched an expeditionary trip by one of its massive icebreakers into the Arctic, again through going through international waters, but very close to Russian territory, which is, of course, the route to the Arctic, as most of Russia lies in the Arctic. And after that, the Russians were very quick to try to close up international waters in the Sea of Ohotsk to prevent perhaps an expeditionary trip by more Chinese military vessels into those waters. So each time you see a very quiet but very significant reaction from the Russians, reflecting the concerns that you raised in your introduction. So that's the Asia-Pacific, quite a lot of complexity there. Russia and China not just thinking about the relationship with the United States, but other players. It's not just Japan, of course. It's also what happens in Korea and both the relations with the North and the South that become factored in. You've talked about Eurasia and Central Asia, but it's also in Europe. As you rightly mentioned, Ambassador Roy, there's been a turning point in China and Russia's relationships over Ukraine, but China has made it clear quite frequently that it doesn't always like the activities and behaviour of Russia in the European space. Not only did China make its displeasure felt over the annexation of Crimea in 2014, but during an earlier war in the broader region with Georgia in 2008, you may recall that Russia made the step to recognise the independence of the two secessionist territories of Georgia, Abkhazia and South Ossetia, and China most notably did not. And in fact, China provided cover later in 2008 for the Central Asian states to also resist recognising Abkhazia and South Ossetia as independent states. There was a meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organisation in Central Asia. There was considerable pressure on the Central Asian states at that point to also recognise the independence of these states. And at that summit, the Shanghai Cooperation Organisation, the Central Asian states managed to resist it and made it quite clear that they were doing this with the support of China behind the scenes. So again, this complexity. There's also been, from the Russian point of view, a bit of an unseemly rush by European countries, both East and Western European countries, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Serbia, Greece, a whole host of countries, to sign on to Chinese infrastructure initiatives and to seek Chinese funding through the AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, for high-speed rail and road linkages. I mean, we've yet to see most of this constructed. But Russia is increasingly looking less like a player in the economies of the regions where it might have been in the past, and China is looking more of a competitor in regional economic calculations as well. So I just want to conclude there by just echoing what Ambassador Roy has said, that although this is a very important relationship, there's a lot of strategic elements, there's a great deal of shared perspective, there are also elements of competition, and there are other players in this mix that we also have to factor. So even though I was suggesting, you know, should we change the title to is the United States losing Russia to China, I think, frankly, none of these states are ours to lose. It's not all about us, and there are many more players here, and we're a much more complex environment. And I think, you know, just, again, to compliment you on your introduction, we have to understand that complexity and take a much larger perspective when we're really trying to figure out what's happening here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for putting the relationship, triangular relationship, in broader, you know, geopolitical regions, and look at the various countries, big and small, how to look at that relationship. And also that when you mentioned that we need to change the title, I cannot help but start laughing, because when we sent the draft to you, I thought that you would change it. But actually survive, but now I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah.
I decided to wait so I'd have at least something to say.
Okay, now we will go back to that point. This is certainly reinforced that different countries have different perspectives, even within countries have multiple perspectives on that issue. Certainly, we use that provocative title to try to stimulate a real debate. And, Sunyuan.
Well, thank you very much. It's such a great honor for me to be on the same panel with distinguished guests like Cheng Li, Ambassador Roy, and Fiona. I really cannot claim the expertise that Cheng Li accredited me for. I primarily work on China, and I consider my job is to understand the logic of China's foreign policy, especially towards developing countries, conflict countries, and authoritarian regimes. So I'll provide what I understand as China's perspective of the recent developments in the Sino-Russia relations. So in the Chinese perspective, Western observers usually reach one of the two conclusions about Sino-Russia relations. So Western observers usually either see an emerging Beijing-Moscow alliance that is aimed at changing the existing international order, or they would dismiss the Sino-Russia intimacy as a temporary meeting of interests out of expediency. But in the Chinese perception, neither position really accurately reflects the current nature of the relationship, which in China is understood as a genuine convergence of national interests, despite the presence of competitive and alienating elements. At least from the Chinese perspective, a third option, which the Chinese call it either partnership without alliance or alignment without alliance, is possible and could be durable, especially if both China and Russia agree that their overlapping strategic interests outweigh their diverging ones. So China-Russia relations have been on a very positive trajectory since Xi Jinping assumed office in early 2013. He and Russian President Putin has met very frequently, 17 times since early 2013, in both bilateral settings and in various multilateral venues in which the two countries both have membership. And those multilateral organizations include the BRICS, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the G20. So Xi Jinping and Putin seem to see the world through similar lenses, and they reach similar conclusions about their country's strategic positions in the international system. They both believe that their countries are in a strategic disadvantage vis-a-vis the United States. Putin believes that Russia's great power ambitions are being thwarted and undermined by the West, and he defiantly tried to reassert Moscow's interests in the regions. On the other hand, China sees the U.S. rebalancing to Asia at best as a denial of China's strategic space in the region and access to Western Pacific, and at worst, an attempt to contain China. The Ukraine crisis and the deterioration of Russia-U.S. relations provided additional momentum for closer ties between Beijing and Moscow. For China, the crisis forced the United States to refocus at least some of its attention back to Europe from its pivot to Asia. Beijing enjoyed more breathing space vis-a-vis the U.S. and more leverage vis-a-vis Russia as Russia's vulnerability and isolation increased. In addition to strengthening China's hand in energy negotiations, Moscow has become at least more, Moscow has seemed to become more willing to cooperate in sectors that were previously restricted. For example, using Putin's state visit to Beijing last month as an example, the two sides confirmed the progress that they have made and they will make on the eastern route of the Sino-Russian gas pipeline, which is expected by both countries to become operational in 2018. Russia's largest crude oil producer also reached several deals with Chinese companies, including signing of 20% stake of its Vernachansk unit to Beijing Enterprises, 40% stake of its Eastern Petrochemical to ChemChina, and a joint development of a petrochemical plant in Russia's Far East with CNPC. China and Russia also signed the IPR agreement on aerospace and aviation cooperation, which is believed to pave the ground for the Russian sales of the RD-180 rocket engines to China soon. Beijing believes that the new regional and bilateral dynamics have made Moscow more open-minded and accept China's Silk Road Economic Belt initiative across Central Asia. China understands very well that in the early days of the initiative after in 2013 and 2014, Russia had very strong suspicion and reservation about the initiative in its traditional sphere of influence. Nevertheless, given the so far favorable reception of the initiative by Central Asian countries and the possibility of actual benefits that it could bring to Russia, Russia seems to be more open-minded and interested in what Russia can gain from the initiative, especially in terms of infrastructure development. So we know that China's Silk Road Fund and China Development Bank have committed part of the financing for the Moscow Kazan high-speed railway. If successful, the project could mark the beginning of a new page of Sino-Russian infrastructure cooperation. The other consideration of Russia is also to connect and integrate the Belt and Road Initiative with the Eurasian economic community in order to prevent exclusivity or Chinese dominance. It is nothing new, really, for China that there are concerns about Russia within China and vice versa, because it is a peril of proximity and also the peril of history. The Chinese will always remember that however much we dislike the United States, it is Russia who took most of our lost territories. Similar in Russia, there are also voices warning against China's territorial ambitions about those territories, at least through the Chinese migration. Putin's nationalism in China is perceived to be not only aimed at the West, but also aimed at China. Some Chinese observers speculate that is precisely the reason why Russia is reluctant to sell its core military technologies to China and reluctant to open up its economy to Chinese trade and investment and to allow for more Chinese participation in the Russian Far East. Within South and Southeast Asia, China is suspicious of and antagonized by Russia's strategic and military ties with countries like India and Vietnam. As an energy importer, China also believes that its interest in lower prices of the energy resources and interest in stakes in oil and gas assets in Russia fundamentally differ from that of Moscow as an energy exporter. The repeated hiccups in the western route of the Sino-Russian gas pipeline is an example of this conflict. China's economic slowdown has affected its future demand for energy. And given the diverse sources of natural gas from Central Asia, China is increasingly hoping to have a better negotiation about the price for natural gas and join the upstream development in Russia. But this is not necessarily what Russia is interested in. Nevertheless, the Chinese continue to make nice with Russia. And as they have at least privately acknowledged, we have worked closer with Russia for less. From the Chinese perspective, strategic alignment with Russia has many concrete benefits. And the negative factors can be managed. They cannot be eliminated, but they can be managed. This is particularly true when China feels that it is dealing from a position of strength and Russia is at a strategic disadvantage. So a couple of points that the Chinese analysts and government officials would like to make, including one, with a 3,000-mile-long border, Russia has the most impact over China's immediate national security and vice versa. So Sino-Russia hostility is undesirable and unlikely in the near future. This point was also emphasized by Madame Fuying in her articulation. The second point from the Chinese perspective, of all the countries, Russia shares China's strategic interest most. Both have domestic political issues and foreign policy aspirations that make them the targets of the United States. Both feel their strategic spaces are being suppressed by Washington. Therefore, China and Russia share a common interest in, quote, quote, maintaining the balance in the international politics and creating a more just international order. The implied message is also apparently pointed towards the United States. A third point is among all powers, Russia and China probably have the most similar authoritarianist ideology. Both insist on their own political systems and economic development path. Both reject Western color revolutions and military interventions. There is ample common ground for consensus. The fourth point is that Russia and China are strategically complementary for each other. Russia is, in terms of the foreign policy style, the Chinese feel that Russia is good at confrontation, while the Chinese are good at maneuvering. One is energy exporter, the other one is importer. One has natural resources, the other one has the money and the cash. So the last point about the border, despite disagreements or complaints inside the Chinese policy community from time to time, the consensus in China is still that the border has been settled for decades. So no one should realistically expect China to reclaim what was given to Russia years ago. So that case has been closed. So as Russia and China surveyed their geopolitical landscape, there is a lot of things to unite them. However, history has also taught them the perils of alliance. Their former alliance relationship has damaged both sides' confidence in the wisdom and the feasibility of a similar arrangement. That does not mean, however, that China and Russia would not align their positions on issues that they see common interests. Such an alignment will enhance the security and economics of both China and Russia, and it is in their views beneficial to maintain the balance of the world order. A China and Russia that align positions against the West while maintaining a safe distance from each other would be more effective than an alliance relationship. Last but not least, just to point out, a major weakness of Sino-Russia ties actually lies in their economic relations, which is fragile and subject to easy influence by external factors. And it very much lags behind the political intimacy between the two. While China is Russia's second largest export destination and the largest import supplier, bilateral trade with Russia only marks about 2% of China's total foreign trade. And last year, this bilateral trade dropped by 28%, including a 19% drop of Russia export to China. This trend has continued this year. So during the first 3 months of this year, the bilateral commodity trade further dropped by 12%. So the drop of the price of natural resources, the depreciation of the Russian currency, and the Chinese economic slowdown all contributed to the downturn or the deterioration of the trade relations. However, in the long run, how to improve the trade structure between the two and diversify their industry trade is a question that both Beijing and Moscow are trying to answer. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Well, really another excellent presentation, and you're so articulate, so effective. Sometimes I misperceive you as a spokesperson for the Chinese government.
Or I'm not.
3 billion people. But of course, that you have your own view, own analysis, I will go to ask you later on. Now, we enter the question period that I will first ask a general question for all of you, and then probably have a couple of questions for each of you. Now, the general question or a set of questions is, do you see the emergence of a new Cold War? Or can the triangular relationship be managed in a more cooperative rather than conflicting manner? Now, both Sun Yun and Ambassador mentioned about Fu Ying, especially her article in Foreign Affairs. In that article, she wrote, I quote, "From the Chinese perspective, the tripartite relationship should not be considered a game in which two players all against a third." Do you think that her description feasible? So these are the general questions to ask each and every one of you. Who would like to begin?
I think it is feasible. And quite frankly, I think that we undermine our diplomacy when we try to think or behave as though our goal is to manipulate the triangular relationship. We have reasons with both China and Russia to not have the relationship drift toward a hostile type of Cold War relationship. And I'm not an expert on the Cold War, but I spent 45 years as a U.S. diplomat, much of which was during the Cold War, serving in places like Beijing and Russia. And the tenor of our relationship with China now, with all of the serious problems we have in the South China Sea and on other issues, is so different from the tenor of our relationship with Russia during the Cold War, with the Soviet Union during the Cold War, that I shudder when people talk about a new Cold War in U.S.-China relations. Russia never had hundreds of thousands of its best and brightest students flooding our universities. At that time, you cannot go to China without encountering U.S.-educated people at the top levels of the Communist Party, at the top levels of the universities, at the top levels of the business community. I mean, it's a very different type of relationship. And let's not forget that very recently, we were getting along fine with Russia. President Bush, in the early stages of his administration, as you recall, looked into Putin's eyes and thought that this was somebody we could get along with. And when we decided to intervene in Afghanistan, Russia actually facilitated our access to Afghanistan through Central Asia, as opposed to opposing it. At the moment, we are inclined to demonize Putin, and one can easily list all of the iniquities that are there. But I like to read the Federalist Papers, and in Federalist 63, James Madison said that one of the reasons you should pay attention to the opinions of other countries is because it's a corrective to when you are being caught up in domestic passions over a particular issue, and it's wise to look at the views of the objective external world in order to control your passions. It's worth bearing in mind that three of the leaders who get along swimmingly with Putin are Prime Minister Abe of Japan, are Xi Jinping of China, and President Park of South Korea. So if we can't get along with Putin, let's bear in mind that countries with whom we have quite close relationship, including alliance relationships, do not find him a type of person they can't deal with. That doesn't mean we don't have very serious differences with Russia, but it means we shouldn't attribute the differences to the personality of the leader of Russia, who has, of all of the countries involved in the Ukrainian crisis, the highest level of popular support for the position that he's taking, as opposed to any of the other countries, including the United States. So I consider this is an issue where skillful diplomacy can steer us away from a Cold War relationship with either Russia or Beijing. And I think that we would greatly benefit if we could get ourselves back into that favorable position in the triangular relationship, which we occupied for several decades.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Fiona?
Well, I think this underscores why we've benefited so much from your diplomacy in the past. And, you know, perhaps we might be able to learn a thing or two in moving forward from your remarks, Ambassador Roy, because I couldn't underscore enough the importance of thinking about the factors at play and think about things in a much broader perspective looking forward. This is a very different dynamic, as I think we've outlined, from the Cold War. This is not an ideological struggle, and I think as all of us have outlined, and as you've outlined very clearly here from the Chinese perspective, there's not much ideology at play here. There's very much a different perspective on how you want to run your country and engage in foreign policy, which produces a lot of challenges for us that we have to manage. There's obviously a lot of differences in perspective here, but that really is the art of diplomacy. And I really like what you said about China and Russia maintaining their difference, the distances from each other, being acknowledging of their differences in their own perspectives, but maintaining that distance even at the same time that they align. And I think that should also be a lesson to us. We're not going to be particularly close either to China and Russia for a variety of different reasons. We actually ironically have a much closer relationship with China, as Ambassador Roy has outlined, in terms of people-to-people to contacts and trade. And it's not just based on the sheer size of China, but there's actually much more of a convergence of economic and trade interests. With Russia, we've always had a very difficult relationship. I mean, we've sat here in many different settings at Brookings and opined on this in many different ways, so I don't want to, you know, go into this in too much detail. But we don't have that basis for deeper trade. The commodity-driven nature of the Russian economy is very similar to ours in many respects, and we don't have the same interests in Russia as a trading state as we do with China or Japan or many of our other economic partners. And people-to-people ties have always been fairly tenuous. There's been a lot of outward migration from Russia historically to the United States, but it hasn't created a constituency of people in the United States in favour of a closer relationship. We have an awful lot of Russians working and studying in the United States, but we don't have the same numbers of Americans in Russia in the same way now that we have students and business people going to China. So that substance of the relations at the grassroots is missing, and we tend to get obsessed then with the strategic elements of the relationship. So perhaps we could take a leaf out of our approach to China and start thinking of different ways of managing the relationship with Russia. We have an opportunity for a new chapter with our presidential election. We don't know how that's going to come out of this particular perspective. One of our presidential candidates has a very different perspective, perhaps than traditionally, about how we might manage those relationships, which would involve very much changing the alliance structure in the Asia-Pacific in particular, not just to mention in Europe. But this might still nonetheless be an opportunity for us to think afresh. And if we are very concerned about getting into a new Cold War relationship, which I agree with Ambassador Roy, is actually avoidable, then perhaps this is the time to start thinking about how we might change that. And also bearing in mind that there are so many other players in this, and we have to think outside the triangle about how we manage the relationships, how we factor in Japan and Korea, South Korea, two very close allies of the United States, different relationships, both with Russia and with China in the Asia-Pacific, for example. So I couldn't agree more with the importance of thinking of this differently and avoiding that scenario. Mm-hmm.
So, Yin.
I'll be very brief. I agree completely with Ambassador Roy and Fiona. But I want to make three points. The first point is, well, we all say that we are against the Cold War style thinking or the Cold War thinking, but the Cold War style thinking is actually quite prevalent in our countries. And we hear, for example, the Chinese government and the Chinese analysts always claim that we should eliminate the Cold War thinking in international relations. But when they say that, my reaction is, well, you have the most Cold War thinking in dealing with other powers. So there's a factor of mirror effects and a factor of their own belief in such judgments. But the point is that I think the Cold War thinking is that exists. But I don't think it is Cold War. I don't think it's ideology driven. And although the disputes and disagreements are intense, the confrontation is not at the same level as it was during the Cold War. And like Cheng Li, your many articles and publications have argued that the economic relations between U.S. and China is so important that the two countries cannot really afford to get into a confrontation or another Cold War scenario. And the engagement by the United States, also the bilateral dialogue channels are also open. We have Ambassador Roy and among many other veterans and senpais managing the direction of the bilateral relations. The last point I want to make is we know that the Chinese leader Xi Jinping, he has proposed the new type of major power relations since he assumed office in 2013. But there is this sense in China that this new model of major power relations has actually transpired between China and Russia somehow, because the two countries are able to maintain their disagreements and keep their differences, but prioritize the pursuit of cooperation on more practical matters. So there is actually a calling, even in Madame Fu Ying's articulation, that United States should learn from that experience and try to deal with China and Russia in a similar manner. But then, of course, it's very easy to say, because China and Russia, in this case, they do see a common threat, which is the United States. And the U.S. may not have the same luxury on issues of principal matters. So whether that is whether it is applicable in the case of the United States remains to be seen.
Well, thank you. Now, for time concern, I just want to have one question for you each. For the question for Ambassador is that you mentioned about Putin, you also mentioned about Xi Jinping. How important has the personal relationship between Putin and Xi Jinping been to the current Sino-Russia relationship? And some foreign observers think that these two leaders are quite similar, two strong men are quite similar. And what, in your view, are the major differences between Putin and Xi Jinping? And what do these differences mean for the United States in our policy towards these two countries?
You want me to answer this?
Yes.
In the one or two minutes?
Yes.
I think that, as I outlined in my opening remarks, I didn't base my analysis on personalities. I based it on what I considered the underlying strategic factors that were affecting relations among all parts of the triangular relationship. You don't have an option to pick the leaders that other countries end up with. It's nice if you like them and you find them easy to deal with, but if you don't like them and don't find them easy to deal with, you still have to deal with them. President Nixon didn't go to Beijing because he liked Chairman Mao and found him easy to deal with. And if you read the transcripts of their discussions, you will discover it was not an easy relationship. But the president thought that it was in the national interest of the United States in order to have a better relationship with China. And he dealt with Chairman Mao on that basis. I think that both President Putin and Xi Jinping are reflecting the national interests of their particular countries in dealing with each other. I think both of them recognize that they are leaders who have serious domestic difficulties they have to deal with, and important foreign policy interests where there's a convergence between the two countries. And so I think they respect each other as leaders. But I don't think that it's the chemistry between Putin and Xi Jinping that has caused the improvement in Sino-Russian relations over recent decades. I think it's the underlying strategic factors, the changes in the world situation, and to a significant degree, U.S. behavior that has caused these two countries to find that there are common interests that have created this improved situation in the bilateral relationship between the two countries, despite the imbalances between the two countries and the inequality of the suspicions that exist on each side in the relationship.
And the major differences between them?
Yes. I think that Xi Jinping did not approve of Putin's behavior in Ukraine. It's very clear China has concerns that were adversely affected by having a precedent of using a referendum to separate essentially to destroy the territorial integrity of a country that Russia had formally recognized the territorial integrity of. China hasn't completed its unification process. It's very sensitive about these factors. And it's a factor that we haven't mentioned, that the areas where China needs action, the United States is a more important player than Russia is. In other words, a relationship with Russia is not going to solve the Taiwan problem in a way that Beijing would look favorably on. And China's behaving in the South China Sea in a way that Russia cannot be entirely supportive of, because Russia still wants to have that good relationship with Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget that the Sino-Vietnamese border clash in 1979 was a function of the Vietnamese having thrown out the China-leaning Khmer Rouge in Cambodia and substituted Vietnamese-leaning Khmer Rouge, and the fact that Vietnam and the Soviet Union had concluded a defense agreement that Deng Xiaoping thought was a threat to China's interests, and he wanted to teach Vietnam a lesson. So that it was the closeness of the Sino-Vietnamese, of the Russian-Vietnamese, the Soviet-Vietnamese relationship at that time that was a contributing factor to the border clash between China and Vietnam. So these are considerations you have to bear in mind as background factors in the relationship.
Thank you. My question for Fiona, because both you and the ambassador mentioned about the educational exchanges and the impact of people-to-people diplomacy. Now I want to follow up with a specific question. And before that, let me share with you some data. And currently, there are about 20,000 Chinese students studying in Russia, while over 300,000 are studying in the United States. In 2013, fewer than 5,000 Russian students studying in the United States. And only 138 U.S. undergraduate and graduate students studying in Russia. In the same year, about 14,000 U.S. students studying in China. So these are the data about the student exchanges. Now, based on my research, that the current and the upcoming Chinese leaders, very few of them study in Russia. And they usually send their children to the United States. Some of them themselves study in the United States, with except of a few major generals in the PLA study in Russia. Now, here's my question. Does that really reinforce that our title for this panel is correct, that we have much stronger ties with China than with Russia because of the impact of these strong bonds in terms of foreign students, in terms of exchanges, and et cetera? The related question is, from Russia's perspective, from Putin's perspective, with this kind of number, data, does he really trust the Chinese or Chinese leaders? So what all this means for our policies?
Well, this is a very multi-layered question here. And, you know, let's, you know, start on a very practical basis. The language study is, in many respects, a utilitarian base of education. You know, when you're studying a language, it's not just for the importance of getting a greater cultural understanding, but it's also often for, you know, purely pragmatic reasons. It's kind of an investment in the future, perhaps for employment. I can see an awful lot of younger people sitting in the audience here who've probably been thinking about these questions. I studied Russian back in the 1980s because Russia was, you know, the main event the Soviet Union was in the 1980s in the United Kingdom on a security perspective. And it was in the news at all points. I didn't actually expect that I would still have a job studying Russian, but I'm encouraging my younger daughter to study Chinese and Spanish at the moment for employment perspectives, because Chinese and Spanish are two global languages that open up, particularly from the United States, an awful lot of doors for jobs. I'm not thinking that she's going to be sitting here on a panel, you know, sometime 20 years from now, opining on China or Spain, you'd never know, or Latin America. I would just imagine that she might have more of an opportunity of getting a job. And I think that's what a lot of people are thinking about when they make these kinds of decisions. I mean, interestingly, although there is such a relatively small number, seemingly, of Russian students here, there are an awful lot of Russian emigres in the United States. And there are also a lot of Russian workers who have learned English back at home in Russia, where English is very well studied to extraordinarily high level and has been since, in fact, the Soviet period. I was always amazed at how well the Soviet students that I met spoke English. And there are, you know, tens of thousands of Russians working in the United States, especially in Silicon Valley, and of course across the whole of Europe. There's lots of other places that Russians who speak English can go and use their English, not just in the United States, because English has become a global language. And I think that's a lot of the motivation for Chinese studying in the United States. It's not just about, you know, learning about the United States, but it's about being in a global marketplace. Now, whether Brexit will change this in Europe and everyone will go back to speaking French, as some of my French colleagues are suggesting, and, you know, we'll have to have a lot of Chinese students rushing out and retooling, I think, is another matter. But I think we can look at some practical issues there. But it is, of course, also providing a basis for shared and deeper understanding. But I don't think that, you know, that explains everything completely. I do think that the economic and trade relationships are more problematic. And I think that that has really reduced an interest in the United States of being more pragmatic about the relationship with Russia. We see less of a basis or less of a necessity for kind of figuring out different, more creative ways about managing this beyond the security relationship. So I think this underpins what Ambassador Roy has said. The Europeans, by contrast, don't have that luxury, as Sun was mentioning before about the United States having to make different calculations. They also have the perils of proximity and the necessity of proximity to Russia. They have a much deeper trade and economic relationship. They have more people-to-people ties, more Russian students studying in Europe, often in English-speaking environments. They have to manage that relationship differently. Now, you asked at the very end about this, about some of the difficulties in that relationship and the various suspicions. There's one set of key elements where President Putin is very different from President Xi and, in fact, from many other world leaders. And the fact that, as the title of the book that I co-authored with Clifford Gaddy, The Operative in the Kremlin, Putin is a career intelligence officer. He's deeply suspicious of everybody. He sees plots and conspiracies at every turn, and he admits it. He's not ashamed or abashed by this. He said, you know, I'm a spy, once a spy, always a spy. You know, I don't trust people. There's a very high barrier for that. There's not just trust, but verify. There's verify, verify, and then maybe not trust, you know, nonetheless. And he will always be deeply suspicious of all of the relationships. He will always be wanting to check and to make sure that no one is trying to outmaneuver him. He's always somebody who also wants to hedge and keep his options open. China is a great hedge for the future, but there will always be these deep suspicions and concerns. And with the United States, we remain, for now, unfortunately, the main opponent. And we have some considerable concerns about Russia for precisely the same reasons the Chinese do. The crisis in Ukraine, the annexation of Crimea, has been a major turning point for us as well, as was the war with Georgia in 2008. And Russia's decisions to recognize the independence of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. I mean, the United States is very concerned about these violations of the established international order. I mean, interesting, this is one area where we do have actually a common perspective, but perhaps for different reasons, with China. And I do think as we think about these relationships for the future again, we have to think about, yes, some of the different perspectives of the personalities and the natures of the countries, but how we have a more holistic view about this, how we factor in the complexities of these relationships, how we don't just see them in this bilateral angle, we'll miss things. Especially as Ambassador Roy said about this important element in the Russian-Chinese relationship about Vietnam and these different perspectives. At each time, we have to think about these broader calculations, and given the United States' role, it's incumbent upon us to take this broader perspective like we're trying to do on this panel.
Excellent. Last question for Sun Yun. Your presentation provides an overall assessment about how Chinese perceive Russia. But are there any important spirits in the country? In what ways the various groups like Chinese leaders, public intellectuals, the military, general public perceive Russia? Do you think they perceive in the same way? Or they are very much divided? And this divide is largely determined by what factors? By pro-US or kind of more anti-US or something else? Could you go a little bit specific to talk about the specific, how the Chinese are divided in these issues, the dynamics or the diversified views in China?
Sure, I will try. Well, within the policy community, I agree with Ambassador Roy and Fiona that the disagreement seems to be less vocal because people do see that the national interest in this case tramples the personal preferences and historical agonies. And it is in the interest of China to align its positions with Russia at this very historical moment, although they do also acknowledge that there is no eternal friends or perpetual enemies. There's only eternal and perpetual national interest. So at this moment, it is in China's interest to work with Russia, and they will do so. Maybe in the future, when the conditions change, I don't think they have any problem changing the nature of that relationship either. It's just the conditions, such conditions have not arisen yet. Then within the public opinion is a little bit more diverse than this consensus in the among the policy folks. The public seems to be hanging on to the historical issues more, and the netizens in China and public scholars, they do talk about the territorial loss to Russia historically. And there are nationalists who argue that, well, Russia should be more supportive of our positions on South China Sea and be more open-minded about opening up their energy sectors to our investment. That's the Chinese energy company's perspective. And they also feel that Russia should be more tolerant and be more cooperative in this bilateral relations given its strategic disadvantage. But on the other hand, within the Chinese public opinion, there's also this tremendous admiration of Putin, that they feel that the Russian leader has achieved what the Chinese leaders have failed to achieve in the international politics, which is respect and the ability to assert the nation's position and protect the nation's interests. So there are callings for Chinese leaders to learn from Putin, which I'm sure that you know, that Chinese leadership should be more assertive and learn from the Russian experience. See, Russia has been able to do all these things without getting into too severe a consequence, so Chinese leaders should learn from them. So those are the more nationalistic sentiment in the Chinese public opinion about Russia, which is different from the policy community's perspective.
Thank you very much. Now the floor is open, and please first identify yourself. Also, please limit your question to one. And also, I just want you to be aware that C-SPAN 3 is covering live. So now, first, Professor Gilbert. And early I referred to the triangle, right? The uneasy triangle is really based on your excellent piece. And so glad to see you. Yeah.
Thank you. Gil Rosman, I now edit the ASEAN Forum. My question is about the dismissal of ideology as a factor. Sure, it's not the old communist ideology, but don't we need to think about issues of national identity? And even in the Chinese response to Ukraine, so much of the Chinese writings talk about the U.S. responsibility, the color revolution, that this was really an ideological or identity challenge to Russia, and they defend Russia in terms of how it had to respond to the U.S. And the second part of this really is, despite last year's downturn in Sino-Russian relations in terms of great Russian disappointment with the lack of Chinese investment and high hopes of 2014 being dashed by how little actually happened, for instance, in bringing together the Silk Road Economic Belt and the European Economic Union. Hasn't something more happened this year? For instance, the reaction to South China Sea ruling in China, the reaction of both to the THAAD deployment decision. Aren't we seeing the possibility of a new upturn because of a sense of what's happening in the United States and their resentments of the U.S. even gaining ground?
Two questions integrated, two parts, as you said. Okay, so who wanted to take?
Okay. Well, Professor Rosman, and great to see you here. And, for people in the audience, you've obviously done a great deal of service to all of us with your writings, not just on this topic, but also on Japan and the broader Asia issues. And you're right that, one has to be careful about completely stripping out the ideological perspective. I think the point we're trying to make that this is not the old set of relationships. And the Cold War was obviously driven by a very deep, intense ideological struggle that was, you know, very clearly defined. This is much more vague in many respects. It's a kind of got elements of great power politics. As you said, there's a degrees of national identity. But it's not really been defined on the United States side in that way. I mean, maybe in some respects it's a one-sided struggle. The United States, for example, doesn't believe that it's been engaging in color revolutions. This is a perspective that has been generated both in Russia and in China. I mean, the United States believes as a kind of a matter of course that it's a very benign and very universally beneficial thing to be promoting democracy, market liberalization, and, you know, general aspects of good governance. It's an intrinsic part of the United States foreign policy. It also is, frankly, of the European Union and most European nations, and is part of the whole thrust of the United States Agency for International Development, international institutions like the World Bank. The United States, you know, our populations tend to, at least up until this presidential cycle, think that this is, you know, the kind of thing that, you know, you do as a matter of course. We don't tend to see it in an ideological perspective as we might have done during the Cold War. But as you rightly point out, that is not the view of many people in China, and is certainly not the view of the inner circle around Vladimir Putin. Putin, in fact, as the old Cold War, you know, operative, in fact, sees an awful lot of this activity as old CIA active measures from the Cold War period, and doesn't, you know, kind of really see, in many respects, the distinction. And there's very much a strong view that the United States has been driving many of the upsurge and uptick in insurgencies or revolutionary activity, demonstrations, political protests, beginning with Georgia, you know, as you're pointing out, these color revolutions, but also through the Arab Spring, which, of course, is not the perspective that we've had here in the United States at all. Now, we could have actually done an awful lot more, getting back to the questions and that were posed earlier and the responses by Ambassador Roy, in managing those perceptions. I mean, in actual fact, when the color revolutions in Georgia and Ukraine first took place in the early 2000s, we did, in fact, have some instances of U.S. Foreign policy professionals kind of laying claim to these. I remember actually myself being at a meeting of this and thinking this was a very stupid move, and that we should have been very quick to point out that the United States didn't have any role in this, and that we weren't in the business of manipulating and exploiting protests. So actually, I think, you know, we've done ourselves a disservice in helping to foster this idea that we've played some kind of role in this, not being very quick to address these misperceptions. And this is the same kind of issue, I think, that we're dealing with the South China Sea ruling. I think we just have to be better in our political communication. We have a real problem in our own hands, and we don't always manage these issues especially well. So it really is a challenge for the future. I think you're absolutely right. We could see an uptick. And because of what's happening in the United States, the fact that we're preoccupied with our own politics at the moment, we're going to be preoccupied with it for a heck of a long time to come, I suspect, we're going to have a really a serious challenge in dealing with these issues head on. It's going to take very deft diplomacy, and it's going to be very difficult. And I do think you're absolutely right. There's going to be an awful lot more of these problems that we face with. But I do think that it's a problem that we could address head on, and it's a factor for better political communication and much better diplomacy.
Thank you. Probably we'll go to another, Yu Donghui. Yeah. Please also tell that to whom this question is addressed.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Donghui Yu with China, the Real News Agency of Hong Kong. My question is for Ambassador Roy. And in the past 2 weeks, we have seen a lot of meetings between the U.S. and China. You know, Susan Rice is visiting Beijing right now. And also, we see that both sides is trying to lower the tension because of the South China Sea. Considering the G20 summit will be held in Hangzhou very soon, and in which President Obama and President Putin will participate, how would you expect the triangle relations to evolve after the G20 summit? Because China will see this summit as its bigger role in the international arena. And secondly, do you expect the U.S.-China high-level exchange mechanism will continue if Donald Trump is get elected? Thank you.
You can escape the second if you don't want.
It's a good question. The first part. It's very easy to see that China and the United States have some very difficult issues that we need to manage in the bilateral relationship, issues that if mismanaged could push our relationship in a negative direction rather than a positive direction. And certainly the South China Sea is one of them, because it involves territorial issues, and territorial issues are always sensitive between sovereign states. But at the same time, our mechanisms for dialogue with China are the best we've ever had. We have frequent, not as frequent as Putin and Xi Jinping, but Xi Jinping and President Obama have had frequent meetings. And a special characteristic of it, which even Putin, I don't think, has, is they will spend hours together mm-hmm. in discussion so that you can get beneath the surface of issues and not simply run through your talking points. And this is reflected in what's going on now. I think in part in preparation for the G20 meeting in Hangzhou, the president's national security advisor has gone to China, not for the first time. She knows the people she's dealing with in China effectively. We've just had our chief of naval operations over in China. And I can't believe that they didn't discuss the South China Sea and have some exchanges on it. So in other words, the channels for communication between China and the United States are wide open, and we are utilizing them. And I think this is the most effective way to try to deal with the full range of issues in U.S.-China relations. Because every time our presidents get together, they issue a joint statement talking about 50-plus areas of cooperation between the two countries, none of which gets the slightest bit of attention, because all of the focus is on big issues such as the South China Sea or the deployment of THAAD in South Korea. So my sense is both countries are serious in wanting to manage the relationship in a way that will not let it drift toward a hostile relationship, and that's the way it should be. As for the second part of your question, I defer to my colleagues. It's the job of the Chinese embassy to analyze our domestic political process, not mine.
Fiona, do you want to do?
Well, that was very cleverly said. Yes, I think we're all trying to avoid getting into our presidential campaign. And, you know, I think that overall, these broader factors are very important. And no matter who is elected president here in the United States in November, these are the choices that these are how the choices are going to be framed by these structural factors. And I think just one very quick point on the channels. I think this is where there really is a major difference between the relationship of the United States and China and the United States and Russia. We just simply don't have those channels in the relationship with Russia. Partly that's because Putin's Russia tends to be a bit of a one-man show. It's a bit difficult to be a purely a one-man show in China, given just the sheer size of the body politic, the population, and the still very strong presence of the Chinese Communist Party. I guess President Xi is much more of a big popular figure than some of his predecessors have been, and has been accused on some sides of creating a more personalized presidency. But that really pales in comparison with what's happened, particularly since 2012 with the Putin presidency. When Putin came back for a third term, it made Russian politics so much more about him than it was during, of course, the tandem period with Dmitry Medvedev. And so we have real difficulties in figuring out how to structure that relationship. That was in part what the reset was about during the early parts of the Obama administration, where there were different layers and structures set up to manage the relationships. It wasn't just about the two men on the top, because given the nature of the Russian-US relationship, it's going to be unlikely that President Obama and President Putin are going to have the same frequency of meetings. There's less to talk about in many respects, and just lots of difficult issues to talk about. And, you know, who wants to be sort of sitting in an environment where all you're doing is haranguing each other? I don't think that Putin or Obama particularly enjoy their encounters. whereas Ambassador Roy is saying that there's a little bit more to talk about, and you can get into different layers between Xi and Obama. So this is one challenge that we're going to have moving forward, about how you build a broader basis of relationships, how you create new mechanisms and channels for the Russia-US relationship. But I would also suggest, and maybe Sun might have on a comment on that, that the China-Russian relationship doesn't always have these deeper layers either. That is still something of a top-heavy relationship too, which is probably why Xi and Putin have to meet so frequently.
Okay, great. Yes, it's a young lady.
Thank you, Guan Qingren from Western Media. We all know that last Friday, the DNC, the Democratic National Convention, their internal emails were leaked and made public. And some people say this was probably supported by Putin because it was made published by the Russian hackers. So how do you think of this kind of possibility? Thank you.
We waited so long for your question.
Thanks. I've unfortunately been spending so much time with questions related to the DNC's emails, I can't get to my own email, so I apologise publicly to anyone who's emailed me recently. I'm looking forward to my emails being on WikiLeaks so that other people can respond to them for me. Frankly, we don't know who has hacked the DNC files. The strong suspicion is that it's Russia because, along, frankly, with China, the Russians have the strongest capabilities, well, the United States as well, actually, we have to admit, being able to undertake this kind of operation. Even if it does prove, and the FBI and others are looking into this now, and, of course, there's been an awful lot of inquiry into this the first time around, this is not the first news of this hack. This took place several months ago, in fact, and we've already had one leak of information related to the Trump campaign at a rather propitious moment in the election cycle. The timing is not accidental, let's say, by WikiLeaks or by anyone else in releasing the certain caches of information. This was obviously timed for this release to the high point of the convention where Senator Bernie Sanders was going to be appearing, because those emails that were leaked were very much related to the difficulties his campaign experienced. So, again, it's not old news. There's been an awful lot of investigative reporting to find the different groups behind this. There's very strong suspicion that they're directly related to Russian intelligence, different parts of Russian intelligence. But there's no definitive proof of this. The question is really, if it is Russian intelligence, why would they want to do this? And this gets back to the comment that I made before about Russia and Putin and, the worldviews that we have expressed here, this feeling of being in competition with the United States. Back to Gil Rosman's question about the perception of color revolutions, of a strong feeling that the United States always tries to influence domestic politics, periods of domestic weakness, and might be interested in the business of regime change. And if you are in the business of intelligence in Russia or elsewhere, well, you're in the business of basically also counterintelligence. If you believe that the United States has been doing this kind of thing, then you want to pay them back with the same kind of activity. We've already had the release of taped phone conversations between US government officials. During the Ukraine crisis, there was a telephone conversation between a State Department official and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine that was put on YouTube at a very sensitive moment in that crisis. And that obviously created a great deal of controversy. Again, there was suspicion that this was the Russians. It had the Russians' MO all over it. So, I mean, in many respects, we really shouldn't be surprised because from the Russian perspective, and again, President Putin is unashamed of the fact that he was a KGB operative. He takes great pride in Russian intelligence. You might remember when the story broke that there were Russian sleeper agents, the infamous Anna Chapman, who became something of a media darling back in Russia, the rather glamorous young woman who was revealed to be a Russian spy. Putin met with them all publicly when they returned. There was no shame in the fact that they there was a great deal of disappointment, I imagine, that they had been uncovered, but there was no shame in this at all. Putin makes no secret of the fact at any point that he relishes Russia's prowess in spying. They have not admitted to this, and in fact, in many respects, it's better to have a great degree of ambiguity because it makes everybody nervous. You know, we're all probably sitting here wondering how much they're in our emails. You know, and there's an intimidation factor about this. So, you know, why would you show your hand? Because there's a great deal more of tactical surprise. Again, this is not to say that we have any definitive proof, but we should not be surprised that this kind of activity goes on. And again, the Russians take pride in the first-class abilities of the intelligence services.
Great. Yes, the young lady.
Hi, my name's Meg Egan. I'm a graduate student in international affairs. My question is about, we hear a lot about the U.S.-China or U.S.-Russia relationship regarding Syria and Iraq and everything that's going on there, but China is very absent from that domain. So I'm curious as to how you think some sort of attack in China would change that, especially given that the Chinese tend to think more long-term than United States and probably Russia as well. Thanks.
One of you, maybe either Sun Yun or Ambassador.
Let me, the question is, there's a lot of attention to the Russian factor in the Syria ISIL, Daesh problem in the Middle East. China is very concerned about domestic terrorism. They are particularly concerned about terrorism that links to the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, where there are some external organizations that claim to be trying to stimulate resistance or separatist forces in the area. Clearly, if there a linkage emerged between ISIS and Uyghur terrorism in Xinjiang, the Chinese would treat this as a top priority issue. There is cooperation and intelligence exchange among countries that are in concerned about this type of terrorism, and I think China is part of that process. But I don't expect that China would become interventionist on those issues because of its concern over this type of terrorism, but they would probably step up cooperation with countries that were in a position to uncover intelligence that would be useful to China in dealing with any potential internal threats that were connected to that. But China tends to be critical of intervention in other countries and issues. And while China is giving a lot of attention to trying to strengthen its ties in the Middle East, it is not yet in a position of wanting to actually commit Chinese forces to intervening in those areas.
Okay, we'll pick up a few questions, and especially a question for Sun Yun, and in the back, the three gentlemen who raised your hand. Yes.
Yes, hi, thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Greg Strax. I'm with the National Bureau for Asian Research. My question is actually about the One Belt, One Road initiative and the integration with the Eurasian Economic Union, which you mentioned earlier. It seems that it's progressing slowly, as Professor Rosman mentioned. Can you just talk about some areas of success that there has been in this area, whether that's in Russia or in other countries in Central Asia?
Okay, one. Second. Yeah, we take
Greg Thielman, Arms Control Association. One aspect of the triangle between China, the U.S., and Russia is that each of these countries can annihilate the other two countries with nuclear weapons. So my question really is, given China's slow but steady increase in its nuclear capabilities, which seem to be oriented almost exclusively at defending itself against the U.S., how does Beijing think about the Russian nuclear threat? Is it below the surface, or is it about as alarming to them as the U.S. worrying about the British and French nuclear threat?
Very good question. And third, maybe the gentleman in the back. Yeah. Two of you. Yeah, that's fine. Both of you. You can ask first. Yes.
David Sedney with CSIS. My question is really for all the panelists. You've laid out a situation where, as Ambassador Roy said, in the triangular relationship, China seems to have the advantage. Do you have any specific recommendations for what the United States could do to try and swing that advantage towards the U.S.? Thank you.
Last one, yes.
My name is Wang Fan, a graduate student in international affairs in University of California, San Diego. And my question is for Ambassador Roy. And what do you think of the phenomenon that American presidential candidates always speak ill of China and Russia a lot during their campaign, but after getting elected, they are more practical and flexible when dealing with China and Russia? Thank you.
This is including Donald Trump, okay. yes. For One Belt, One Road?
Sure. On the One Belt, One Road initiative, I agree with you. I think the integration of the two frameworks are progressing very slowly. And the most we have heard is rhetoric and about the discussions that the two governments and two top leaders have had about the integration. But my suspicion is that some of the projects that the Chinese are contemplating with both Russia and Central Asian countries are going to be categorized under the cooperation category or the integration category between the two frameworks. That should not be too difficult a task to complete. Also, a very short comment on counterterrorism and the question about China's involvement in Central Asia, South Asia, and Middle East. I think the attacks that have happened in China so far by Uyghur population have already motivated Chinese government to take a more serious attitude towards the cooperation on counterterrorism and to enhance its role in these regions. Although there is a problem in that process because I wouldn't name which country it is, but in the process of such cooperation, it is also discovered that if China has most motivation, most interest in cooperating with these governments because of counterterrorism, then what is the incentive for that government to eliminate that problem so that they can no longer solicit the Chinese cooperation in this regard? So we hear the Chinese talk about this at least privately, that some governments are cooperating with China, but they are not also not cooperating with China.
Do you have a comment on the nuclear issue?
The nuclear issue, the strategic stability dialogue is ongoing between not only China and the United States, but also China and other nuclear powers. I don't think in the Chinese policy community's perception, Russia's nuclear weapon is targeted at China. So that's not a commonly shared perception.
Okay. Ambassador, special question. I think that your friend, Dr. Kissinger, also at a number of occasions talk about China may now have leverage in the triangular relationship in contrast to the Cold War when U.S. had leverage. So do you want to address that question? And also there's a question
about
the election.
I'll briefly comment on this. I agree with this on the nuclear missile issue. There are two ways to defuse threats. One is to have a power position which enables you to deal with the threat, and one is to simply create a political relationship in which the threat is not a relevant factor. And I think that in the case of Sino-Russian relations at the moment, China is simply not concerned about the potential of a nuclear attack on China, and China has a nuclear deterrent in case that judgment proved wrong. So this is not a subject that keeps Chinese leaders up at night worrying about it. The question was how to deal with the triangular relationship and get the United States back into a favored position. It's a simple answer. It's a question of whether or not the United States can manage our relations with China and with Russia in such a fashion that the national interest is served by having the United States back in a situation where we have better relations with those two capitals than they have with each other. At the moment, that's not an easy task, but we ought to be thinking in those terms because, again, the manipulative concept of managing foreign policy has the same detriments that you would have in a social situation if a friend was considered only interested in manipulating your friendship so that they could gain some particular advantage. You do not advance your diplomacy by giving the impression that your sole purpose in having a relationship with an important foreign country is so you can use that country against some other country. I know a lot of people think those ways, and I've read articles that talk about how we should be manipulating, you know, China against Russia and Russia against China, et cetera. It's bad diplomacy. Leaders are skilled and diplomats are skilled at figuring out that you're trying to manipulate them as opposed to accomplish something positive. U.S. elections. Why do we criticize China during elections and then behave differently after the elections? There's a simple answer. Candidates are interested in getting elected. And therefore, they tend to not think about the consequences of what they're saying. Their calculations are, will it assist me to get the votes necessary to come into office? The U.S.-China relationship is based on national interests. And that's why presidents of Democratic and Republican persuasions alike, after the election campaign is over, have tended to come back to a common understanding that a bad relationship with China is not in the U.S. national interest, and that we benefit from having a more constructive relationship with China. That dynamic, I think, we'll discover in the terms of the current election campaign in the United States. If the candidates choose to criticize China, they will discover, if they are elected, that U.S. national interest requires a relationship with China that cannot simply be based on criticism of them for the way they are and the way they behave. So I would expect that dynamic to continue to play.
Yeah, we only have 5 minutes left. May take a couple of questions. Yeah, okay. For this one.
Leah from Voice of America. We know that Russia and China have both expressed their oppositions to the deployment of the THAAD system. China had said repeatedly that such a deployment would undermine China's national interests and also destabilize the region. I'm wondering if you think there's some validity to such an argument, whether the United States and South Korea should take China's position a little bit more seriously. Because I could imagine that there could be a chain reaction if China does think that way. And I think they might, you know, they're just not saying their oppositions. They might do something about it.
Let me answer that quickly. Life is filled with contradictions. And Chairman Mao, in his wisdom, wrote a learned article on the correct management of contradictions. The North Korean nuclear and missile development programs have created a potential contradiction, which is it is placed under threat two important U.S. allies in Northeast Asia, South Korea, and Japan. At the same time, the most effective countermeasures against the missile threat has the potential to degrade the nuclear deterrent of both China and Russia. So how do you deal with that problem? The answer is, if you don't deploy the THAAD, you'll essentially be increasing the risk for your allies because of concern about the degradation of the deterrent of countries that you want to get along with. I think the way the United States has handled that issue, in close consultation with South Korea, which has clearly demonstrated it wants a decent relationship with China, is to make the deployment because the threat from North Korea is greater than the potential degradation of the deterrent that China and Russia have against the United States. That is clearly not the outcome that either Beijing or Moscow would have preferred. But they are very aware of the fact that this was not simply a unilateral action or a bilateral action by the United States and its ally South Korea aimed at China and Russia. It was a measure aimed at North Korea because of the inability of the international community, including those particular parties, to be able to deter and halt and roll back the very, very dangerous nuclear and missile developments in North Korea. So this is an issue which is very troublesome, but is manageable because it represents a contradiction, and I think all of the parties understand that it's not simply a unilateral action directed against them primarily.
We are coming to the end of this program. I found that I learned a great deal from Strobe, from particularly from my colleagues who really spend, share your insights and analysis. And particularly, I wanted to go back to your point about the good diplomacy and the bad diplomacy. And also, we look at the China's perspective, it's like an ever-changing in terms of attitudes towards the United States, toward Russia. I think this reminds us that we should be wise, we should be foresighted, and also we should avoid that some countries think they do not have any choice but to have a confrontational policy or form kind of alliance against the U.S. interest. Now, also that particularly I want to thank my colleague that when last time you emailed back, he said you have like 500 emails haven't looked at. Well, now probably 1,000. So again, thank you all of you for come to share with your insights. I hope, of course, that this is really caused some interesting debate. I assume that the Democrat Party is having their convention. No one will watch us. But I think probably Trump's people should watch C-SPAN. I think it's a much better channel for them. And so I want to end up with that. And thank you. I want the audience to join me to thank for the excellent conversation.